Bob Wilbur on clarinet with Ralph Sutton at the piano from an album featuring the world's greatest jazz band. It's 3 minutes after 4 o'clock. This is Fresh Air, and you're tuned to WHYY FM in Philadelphia. And with me is Jonathan Miller, who's one of the rare people able to maintain successful careers and pursuits as divergent as the theater and medicine. Miller was a 26-year-old medical student when in 1960 he collaborated with Dudley Moore, Peter Cook, and Alan Bennett on the satirical review Beyond the Fringe, which was produced for the Edinburgh Arts Festival. The reception at the festival was so good they took the show to the London's West End and then to Broadway. This theatrical success interrupted Miller's medical studies and launched his career in the theater. Since then, he's been TV critic for The New Yorker. He directed opera and drama in England and America, served as an associate director of England's National Theatre, worked closely with Laurence Olivier, and produced several television series for the BBC. American Public Television broadcast his series The Body in Question and carried his series The Complete Works of Shakespeare, which was a production of Shakespearean plays, six of which he also directed. In 1983, Miller announced his retirement from theater and returned to medicine. He's currently using a research fellowship to conduct the study of the human brain. Jonathan Miller has written several books on medicine and anatomy, including The Body in Question, The Human Body, and the latest, The Facts of Life. These last two books illustrate human anatomy and the reproductive system with three-dimensional pop-ups. The Facts of Life and The Human Body are published by Viking Press, and I want to welcome you to Fresh Air. It's a great pleasure to meet you.
Lovely to be here.
Kind of seems like your career's come full cycle. You left medicine in 1960 for the theater, and now you've kind of left theater to go back to medicine. Why'd you leave theater now? You haven't completely left it, though.
No, I haven't completely left, and of course, nothing ever comes full cycle. It's rather like that movie, The Planet of the Apes, with Charlton Heston, and that you make these enormous circuits and come back to the same place, but you find that you and the world have grown 3 million years older, and that's what's happened to me. Things have been changed. I suppose I became less interested in the theatre as time went on. The opportunities for practicing the type of theatrical work that I enjoy have got less and less. The spread of the commercial has really made it more and more difficult to do things without, you know, either movie stars or big stars or working in very large conglomerate theatres, which I don't really enjoy. I much prefer to work in small theatres with good actors. And those are very hard to finance. And so I can't do my work rationally in a way that I would like to pursue it. And so I thought, well, fortunately, I have another interest and another skill, so I could go back to that.
And what are you doing now in medicine?
I work at a university down in the south of England, in Sussex, and I have a research fellowship there, and I move out into hospitals in the vicinity to see patients with brain damage. And I suppose I just talk to them and I do mental tests on them and I devise certain psychological tests to see what happens when certain parts of the brain are damaged.
In 1960, when you started working on The Fringe, did you think that this was going to be it? going to start into the theater?
No, I had no idea about it at all. In fact, it was part of my declared intention, and indeed quite honestly declared intention, that I would go back to medicine as soon as I had finished the show. And then all sorts of other opportunities came up. People started to ask me whether I wanted to direct in the theatre, and that seemed to be interesting, and it seemed in some ways to be consistent with the sort of interests I'd shown when I was doing medicine. I was always interested in speech and language and movement and gesture and so forth. Here was an admirable opportunity for experimenting with it. And I drifted into it more and more and found that I had left medicine. At no point did I ever make a positive decision to leave it. In a way, the decision I made to leave the theatre is the most positive decision I've ever made in my life.
The review Beyond the Fringe was a satiric review, and there was a lot of political satire in it. Could you have poked fun at the Queen or the royal family?
I suppose in a very gentle way we could have done it. I suspect that in 1960 it would have been quite hard for any one of us to have impersonated the Queen. But only a few years later, as you can see from things like the Python show, that she could be impersonated and really quite absurdly lampooned. So I think what happened was that the movement with which we were closely associated, and I suppose that in some senses we were part of a pioneering group, helped to breach these taboos and made it possible for people to flood in through the hole that we'd created and do things which in many ways are far bolder than what we could do. But I don't think they would have been able to do it if we hadn't begun doing it.
Can you remember any of the sketches that you think really hold up now, and maybe one of the sketches that would seem like really hopelessly dated if it was performed today?
No, in an odd way, I think most of the sketches that we did are probably performable today, because I don't think we ever really specifically addressed ourselves to personalities who were in the news at that moment. They were issues which remain current. I mean, we attacked the concept of nuclear deterrence and civil defense and so forth. And I think that with very slight adjustments of the names of the missiles, for example, I think that sketch is performable today. There are very, very funny lines in it which really still apply. I mean, I remember a wonderful line when Dudley Moore played someone who was in the audience. We planted him there, and he said something like, how long will it... How much warning will we have before the missiles arrive? And one of us got up and said, well, that's a very good question. There'll be 4 minutes warning between the launching of the enemy missiles and their arrival in this great country of ours. Now, a lot of people have said, oh, my goodness, 4 minutes, that's not a very long time. To which I would reply, well, there are many people in this great country of ours who can run a mile in 4 minutes. Well, that sort of joke, although the four-minute mile has now been superseded, is still applicable today, and I think it would still get a good laugh. In fact, it still does. In fact, in San Francisco last year, they did a 16-week run of Beyond the Fringe, performing it more or less as it was first done. So it seems to be current in a way that most satirical shows seems in an odd way to die. Most of the stuff is still amusing. I mean, there are also lots and lots of really ludicrous absurdities in the show, which I think were what made it appealing. It wasn't just simply that it was satirical. It was very euphorically and joyously absurd.
I think it's great to be able to look back at your early work and still like it and think it stands up.
Yes, it makes me laugh sometimes when I hear the record, and occasionally when I do bits and pieces for friends, it still makes them laugh. So that I think that... I'm very proud of being associated with it. You know.
Have you kept up with Dudley Moore at all since he's
no,
become
I
a star?
No, I don't really see him. He's out on the coast, and he lives a completely different life to the life that I lead. I suppose that I see him once every 5 years. Very, very rarely if he comes to London, and very occasionally if I go to Los Angeles.
You, during the period that Beyond the Fringe was on Broadway, you were the television critic for The New Yorker.
Yes.
And I was just reading recently one of the pieces that you wrote for The New Yorker. Boy, you didn't have very good things to say about TV. You said the medium itself is depressing. Television is just one of a number of bits of furniture vaguely discerned in the general moon glow. It's a sad, autistic experience that rots the spine and sets one up as a willing customer for all the sleazy remedies that are offered by the commercials, and so on. Do you think television's gotten any better or any worse since 1963 when you wrote that?
It's really got slightly worse. I think it's become much more consistently commercial. The programs which are slipped in between the commercials are dismal and mind-rotting. Occasionally something quite interesting comes up. I think that there are occasional series which are really quite vigorous for what they are. I suppose the Hill Street Blues has got a certain sort of morbid vitality. But I think on the whole, it's junk. And it's an insult to the American public. And it gradually actually alters the character of the American public, which I think that's what's so deplorable about it.
Do you ever think back to the season that you covered when you were writing for The New Yorker, which had the East Side, West Side was one of the new shows, The Defenders was on.
Mm-hmm.
I'm trying to think of what else was on then. But did you ever think about that season and those shows and what you had to say about them?
Yes, they seemed... there was a sort of token liberalism about them. They were run by people who, in fact, would now, I think, often be accused of being, lefties and subversives. They were people who had, or would have been accused, I suppose, under McCarthy, of being premature anti-fascists. So I think things have got worse since then. I don't think they were enormously good, those programs, but certainly they were a damn sight better than most of the things you see today.
So you're going to like them more now in retrospect?
In retrospect, certainly by comparison. They seem, if not paradise, certainly there was a certain sort of substance to them. I mean, it's not all absolutely horrible, but most of it is really deplorable. And the fact that it's periodically interrupted by these mind-rotting commercials of people in a state of euphoric excitement about things which remove biological stains or things which make you smell nicer or beautify you or make your floor polishing easier. And it just produces a sort of a world of shopping mall depression, which is just horrifying, I think.
Do you watch it anyways?
You can't help watching it if you're on tour like I am. Every now and then you come home exhausted in the evening after doing a long tour and you switch on. First of all, it's extremely hard to identify what's on because the chances on the roulette wheel as you turn it round on television of hitting anything other than commercials seems to be very low. So it's very hard to know what's going on. And you have to stick with it until this commercial has come to an end or this cycle of commercials. And then you find, oh, it's something almost as bad as the commercials anyway.
Well, how do you feel knowing that when you're on like a media tour, that when someone's in their room playing roulette on the TV, that one of the things they're going to come across is you?
Well, I'm more or less indifferent to it. I mean, I know perfectly well that one's simply, you know, slipped into a huge electronic blender. I don't expect much more of it than that.
You know, you've done a lot of television.
Yes, I have.
Public television here and BBC in England. Mm. Do you think that BBC and public television are much different?
Yes, they're on a par with one another in the sense that they're both of them committed to the idea that it's possible to raise standards and that you respect the public's intelligence. I think that it's sadly underfunded in this country, which means that it's enormously dependent on what we make in England. And what is so sad, I think, about the state of television in this country is that something as ordinary as, say, Upstairs and Downstairs, which is a perfectly reasonable, sort of slightly perfumed soap opera, is passed off here as masterpiece theatre and has to be introduced by a silver-haired gynaecologist who, sort of with a greased finger stall, introduces it as if it was a suppository which was good for you. It can't somehow, no programme seems to be even put onable here unless it is introduced by an anodyne figure who reassures the public that they won't be poisoned by it.
Well, do you think that Americans think of British accents and British culture as being more refined than their own? And
yes, I think they have a completely daft idea about the English, and they think of it as being inhabited entirely by sort of Bertie Wooster aristocrats speaking in upper-class accents, or else living in an upstairs-downstairs world where there are kitchens filled with maids and butlers, and while upstairs people twirl long-stemmed wine glasses and exchange, you know, upper-class epigrams. And it's absurd. I mean, it's a sort of beef-eating view of the English.
Have you ever thought of why? Why Americans are so enamored of English?
In a sense, there are obvious reasons, because I think America's got a love-hate relationship with England. I mean, after all, it separated itself from England at a very early stage when England was, an imperialist and colonialist power. You did a UDI here, like Rhodesia. And in doing that, of course, there was an affection for the country from which you separated yourself, and also a hatred of it for necessitating a violent war with it. So that Americans are at one and the same time in a state of angry disdain for a country which they visualize as sort of haughty colonial aristocrats, at the same time as, in fantasy, entertaining a view of them being rather interesting haughty aristocrats. So that, I mean, on both levels, it's a fantasy. It's a fantasy as regards its faults, and it's a fantasy as regards its virtues. What England is something entirely different to either the paranoid or the wishful fantasies of the Americans.
Well, are the masterpiece theater things that we get to see on American public television the programs that are the big hits in England?
They are big hits, certainly. I mean, things like Brideshead Revisited and The Jewel in the Crown, the part of the Raj Quartet of Paul Scott, that I think is rather good. I think the reason why Brideshead was attractive both to the English and the Americans was because it excited some sense of nostalgia for the grand old days when things were poised and privileged. But, of course, it's a ludicrous fantasy.
My guest is Jonathan Miller, if you're just joining us, and he's had a long career in theater as well as in medicine and has written several books, the most recent of which is called The Facts of Life. Well, let's talk about some of the series you've done for public television. Mm. Like, you embarked on a series of productions of The Complete Works of Shakespeare. Were they ever completed?
Yes, they've just been completed now, but I didn't do the whole lot, and nor did I produce the whole lot. I was commissioned halfway into the series to do 12 out of the 37 or whatever it is, and I did the middle lot. I certainly didn't embark on the thing, and I think probably Had I been there at the outset, I would never have embarked on it in any case. I think the idea of doing a definitive series of Shakespearean productions is absurd. It certainly is absurd at the level that the BBC set themselves to do it, claiming that it would be a definitive version. There's no such thing as a definitive performance of a play. It will change and be seen to be outdated after about 5 or 6 years. Some of them were quite good and some of them were really quite awful. But certainly there's no way in which it could be definitive. And I think probably to embark on the whole work of Shakespeare is a slightly crackpot notion anyway. What one ought to do is to embark on a production because the play intrigues one. The only advantage of doing the whole lot is that you are forced to come to terms and face plays of Shakespeare which had previously been neglected and which you in which you almost invariably discover hidden and unacknowledged virtues. And that, I think, has been an advantage. Otherwise, I think it's a very dubious enterprise and a very laborious one and an extremely expensive one as well.
It elevates the whole thing, though, into an event.
Well, it becomes hyped and it becomes an event. And again, I think that the American market was slightly... I think what happened was the British took advantage of an American susceptibility to the Bard and Stratford-on-Avon and a sort of beef-eating, half-timbered view of Shakespeare. And that was the way in which the early productions were done. They were done deliberately to cater for this this touristic view of Shakespeare. That led them into a lot of trouble, which I think was one of the reasons why I was asked to come in as a sort of... as a chemotherapist and deal with it.
So what'd you do to
Well, I simply wouldn't. I wouldn't indulge in those sort of half-timbered fantasies of the Bard. I tried to have a fresher view of casting, to crack the stereotypes of the characterizations of the various parts they'd been previously seen, and also not simply do it in this mock Tudor way, which passes for traditional. I was not allowed complete freedom because in the contract which had been drawn up before I appeared on the scene, it was agreed that there would be no, as they called it, messing around, which meant no doing it in modern costume. In other words, it was not allowed to be infected with anything like an idea. Well, I certainly allowed it to be infected with ideas, but not as fully as I would like, as I would have liked. I would like to have changed the things a great deal, done some of them in modern dress, done some of them in quite austere settings, away from the traditional pageant idea, which I think was sold to the Americans at the outset. They were told it would be very colourful and there would be rich silks and things. But again, it's one of the ways in which the English demean themselves in the face of American touristic demands.
What do you think costume dramas are as popular as they are?
Then, well, I suppose it's escapist, that's all, and it fulfills some fantasy.
Makes you feel refined?
Makes you feel refined. It also makes you feel that you've visited. It's like going to Siena and saying we saw the Palio, and, you know, it was very medieval. Well, it's not very medieval. It's just very 20th century touristic... showbiz, and a lot of what is thought to be traditional production of Shakespeare is simply traditional in the sense that it goes back 40 years to what was done then. Certainly, it's quite unlike what Shakespeare did. I mean, for example, it's assumed that it was traditional to do Shakespeare's Roman plays in Roman costume, whereas, of course, Shakespeare and his contemporaries did not perform it in that way.
How did they perform it?
Well, they performed it in Tudor costume with a token costume, something that was thrown over the shoulders of a perfectly ordinary modern costume. In fact, in the 18th century, much of Shakespeare was performed in frock coats and in knee breeches. The idea that modern costume is a perversion of the 20th century is, in fact, an ignorant misjudgment. The idea of doing the plays historically is actually a perversion of the 19th century.
Huh. Do you ever think some people go too far in wanting to... make an older piece contemporary or to personally interpret it to the point of like taking a Molière comedy and doing it as a tragedy?
Yes, I think there are silly things that go on. It isn't that there are limits. I think the silly things that go on are, first, I think the attempt to try and make it speak directly to 20th century problems or problems that are unique to the 20th century in the name of some hideous principle of relevance, which seems to me to be a Philistine and historically suburban view, and comes from what T.S. Eliot described as a gross overvaluing of our own times. We visit the past by doing these plays for the express purpose of seeing how different it was to us. Whereas if you simply make it identical to us, it's simply like, again, it's like tourists going abroad and insisting on living in the types of hotels that they would live in their own country, or insisting on getting, McDonald's when they're in Spain. Well, there are cultural equivalents of that, and one of them is to go to Shakespeare and insist that he address the problems of the Vietnam War.
Well, let me quote you for a second. You were talking about performing Shakespeare in America, and you said that's like growing mustard cress on the moon. You have to bring everything with you.
I think it's extremely hard to do classical European drama in this country because, again, there is a curiously ethnocentric American insistence that the plays of Europe should somehow adjust themselves to American interests. Or what you get is an American touristic view of what Europe is like. And then you're back in that slough of pageantry again. And between the sort of mindless reverence and thoughtless modernity, you simply get nothing at all. I think that in Europe we are freer to take liberties with these classics in restaging them because we are confident of the tradition from which they come. And there's a sort of carefree respect. We understand that intuitively, as it were, the world of aristocratic privilege, which so many of these plays are pictures of, and it's almost hypothetical for Americans. They don't quite understand it, or they have fantasies about it as a sort of Bertie Wooster world filled with monocled aristocrats saying, I say, pip, pip. And I think that it's terribly hard to get American actors to speak Shakespeare nimbly, neatly, and fast.
Do you think Shakespeare has to be performed with a British accent if
no,
you're
I don't
American?
No, I don't think it has to be performed with a British accent. I think it's a British accent as a help because it was written for, a form of diction for which the modern British accent at least makes allowances. I'm not saying that they spoke it in that way. Of course they didn't. But at least there's continuity between the accent that was used in Shakespeare's time and the accents that we have in England at the moment. And what we are accustomed to doing it, is accustomed to speaking Shakespeare, and so it's become second nature. We speak it rapidly and intelligibly, whereas there is a sort of ponderous elocution when the American actor does it, so that it either becomes heavy-handed or hopelessly modernized, in which case all the intimate structures of the verse are simply, again, put through a blender.
Are there any single lines in any of the plays that really drive you crazy because depending on how you say it, it completely changes the meaning of the soliloquy or the passage and the arguments for both sides?
No one speech in particular. Practically all of Shakespeare has got this fertile ambiguity. Until you know who it is that is speaking the lines, you don't quite know what the lines mean. Now, I'm referring here to a rather complex theory which philosophers have discussed in America particularly in the last 15 or 20 years, which is called speech act theory, the idea that sentences don't mean things, or at least they have a minimum meaning which you can extract by paraphrasing them. But what a sentence really means is only determined when you know who it is that's speaking it. And until you have discovered what that character might want to mean in saying such a speech, you don't know what the speech means. It isn't that you can change the meaning of the speech by altering the inflections. You can change the meaning of the speech by altering the character who might want to do something with such a speech. Hamlet, for example, speaking the lines, "Oh, that this too solid flesh would melt, thaw, and resolve itself into a dew." If you view the prince simply as a melancholy Dane, handsome, wistful, gracefully hurt by the events that have overtaken Elsinore, then that speech becomes the sort of incantation that it has been traditionally. Oh, that this too solid flesh would melt. And, there's a famous way of saying it. If, on the other hand, you view him as an irritable and impatient creature for whom what has gone on in Elsinore is a confirmation of a pessimistic view of human nature which he would have had anyway, it becomes a sort of ground out, oh, that this too solid flesh would melt, thaw and resolve itself into a dew, so that there is a sense of being burdened by having a physique. The speech becomes totally different. Much as Claudius's famous speech, oh, my offence is rank, becomes different if you assume that he is not just a lecherous villain, wet-lipped and grape-peeling, gross and lascivious, but is a person who has in fact committed murder in the name of love rather than lust, then that speech becomes totally different again. So in other words, speeches alter, not because you alter the inflections, but rather you alter the inflections because you have actually changed your idea of the person it is who is doing something with the speeches. And this has been said by an English philosopher a long time ago, a professor of philosophy at Oxford, Strawson, who said something like, sentences don't mean things, people mean things by the sentences which they speak.
When you're directing, does what you say go? Like, say, you're interpreting Hamlet as being kind of you know, restless and upset, and someone else sees him as being, you know, the great...
philosophical Dane.
The very great philosophical Dane, yeah. I mean...
Well, yes, I think that in some sense is what I say goes. I mean, for several reasons. First of all, there is the director does tend to have an authority, and the older he is and the more experienced he is and the bigger his track record, the more his actors tend to go along with him. But also, you know, the actors do have choices in the sense that you talk to them before you cast them and say, look, the reason why I'm casting you is because I have this view. And even without that, by casting this actor rather than that, you have already made a choice about what sort of person the character is, so that it may not be necessary even to persuade them. There are moments, of course, when the actor, even though you've cast him with that view, that idea, or cast her with that particular role, idea of the role in mind, may disagree with you in the course of rehearsal, then it's a matter of persuasion and discussion and also of negotiation. Sometimes, and very often, an actor may bring some insight into the part which you simply hadn't had as a director. It's a great deal more reciprocal, I think, than most people care to admit, it certainly is with me. I'm not a dictatorial director. I come with fairly persuasive ideas. Usually I find that I haven't had too much disagreement, but because I think they're damn good ideas, and you've really got to be a fool to disagree with many of the ideas that I have.
well,
I mean, they're really good. They're really good ideas. I think carefully about these texts, and you would have to be very pig-headed to come out and say I'm absolutely in disagreement with that. I mean, I think that most actors simply say that really is a nice idea. I really would enjoy playing it like that. But wouldn't it be good if I was to? And then they will introduce their own. I say, sure, that's very interesting. And I would be a fool to disagree with the ideas offered by such good actors. I choose good actors from whom I'm certain to get ideas which are on a par with the notions which I give to them.
I think that most of your career you've directed works of...
The classical past.
The classical past,
yes.
Yeah. How come you haven't done more contemporary stuff, especially given your desire to not do something in terms of its pageantry or to appeal to that desire
I certainly don't do the past because of its pageantry. I do the past because I'm interested in the history of ideas and I'm interested in history. Pageantry, I hope, plays no part in it. Unless the play happens to include pageant, which it sometimes does. The reason why I haven't done modern plays, I suppose it's... I would like to do modern plays very much indeed, but it's very hard to find them. Once you get a reputation for doing classical plays, you don't tend to get scripts coming in your direction from modern writers. They tend to assume you're not interested in modern life. I would like it very much indeed. But in order to get a good modern play, you have to read 500 horrible plays. Whereas to do a good play from the classical past, you have a fairly well-stocked antique shop where things are being very carefully sifted and selected. You can sometimes be surprised to discover a neglected masterpiece. Or indeed an overestimated masterpiece, which in production turns out to be really rather silly. but not very often. But with modern plays, you simply get lots of junk through the post. And lots of people fancy themselves as writers today, particularly when there's such an emphasis on creativity, a word which would never have been used in the 16th century. And people take courses in creative writing. I mean, imagine Marlowe sitting down at a course in creative writing. Supervising such a course.
What don't you like about that?
Well, it's the idea that people can actually nurse themselves into creativity by tuition. And I think that because everyone wants to be creative, the result is that you get products of their creativity, in inverted commas, coming through the post. Great thwacking scripts of junk. And most people are not artists. They have been encouraged to think that everyone's got a chance to be one. Very few people are artists, although we now offer opportunities for large numbers of people, and large people do take creative writing courses, and unfortunately write creatively as a result of these courses, and they then have access to a postal service. So in the days when there was not so much post and no creative courses at all, you got less stuff coming through.
What do you think it says about us that we have this obsession with being creative?
Well, it's part and parcel of democracy, the idea that every person has an equal right to the privileges of wealth and fame and of justice leads people also to think that they have equal rights to immortality and to posterity. And I suppose they feel that if there's no reason why they can't do it. And I think that democracy has misled people into thinking that we are all equal, but all equal at a very high level. And therefore they don't produce, then it's assumed that it must be a psychological block, so that you then have all sorts of therapies or courses. And on the whole, most writers write because that's what they do, that's what they must do. I don't think that courses help people to write creatively.
My guest is Jonathan Miller, who is both a medical doctor, a researcher on the human brain, and a theater director. He's also produced and directed several television series that have been shown in America on public television. We're talking about contemporary plays, and in the past decade there's been several plays on Broadway by living playwrights about failing health.
Yes,
and I'm thinking like The Shadow Box, which was about people getting cancer. I think Night Mother, which I haven't seen, is about...
And Children of a Lesser God.
Children of a Lesser God, about deafness. Wings, about illness. So whose life is it anyway?
That's right. Well, I think there are several reasons for this. I think that some less commendable than others. I think the commendable reason is that illness is looked upon now as... a peculiar country which some people visit, from which, in fact, interesting information can be sent back. And that, I think, is a very interesting idea of illness, that it's a strange promontory from which you can see a view of the human condition which is not available to those of us who enjoy the spontaneity of ordinary rude health. The less commendable idea, which is associated with a much larger foolishness, it seems to me, is the idea that illness and lunacy certain primitive conditions are, in fact, higher forms of sanity, and that the mad are saner than we ever will be. And that was the sort of perverted idiocy which came out of Ronald Lang, and it led to the... seems to me the malignant nonsense of Equus. The idea that this horse-blinding boy was more in touch with his beautiful blood instincts than the desiccated bureaucratic psychiatrist, which is just simply Lorentzian fascism and malignant tosh. It's all tied up with the idea that dolphins also are wiser than people, than man, and that, you know, these strange, eloquent sounds and that you can hear beneath the ocean are, in fact, the emanations of a subaquatic civilization more sophisticated than we will ever know. The idea that the ill, the disabled, the dispossessed, and the... the as yet uncivilized are in fact sources of wisdom which we had better apprise ourselves of in order to reverse the terrible direction of our morbid civilization. And now it is perfectly true. There are horrible things about our civilization, over-mechanized, over-deterministic, often naively reductionist in its accounts of human affairs. But it's not, those trends are not to be reversed by identifying ourselves with porpoises in dolphinariums or by identifying ourselves with the mentally sick or the paraplegic or the disabled. We should sympathize and do everything we can for the disabled. We should, with a reverence for nature, attend to porpoises just as we do to sparrows. But we shouldn't think that we are, in fact, as it were, sparrows manqués or dolphins manqués, and that we had better imitate the action of the whale.
Do you find this view of failing health and of animals especially offensive because of your work on brain research
my work as a doctor would lead me to think that perhaps it's more tosh than other people might think, but I think you wouldn't have to have any knowledge of medicine to know that it's tosh. It's part of a tremendously sentimental romanticism which exalts all sorts of disabled primitivisms and sees them as higher forms of virtue or wisdom, and that is absolute balderdash. But it's coupled with a tremendous recrudescence of irrationalism. And, I mean, otherwise perfectly sensible people, sensible in the sense that they can, know which pocket to find their handkerchief and blow their nose without, blowing the top of their head off, still have beliefs in things like reincarnationism. I mean, quite sensible people who can put one word after another in a decent sentence can actually seriously entertain the idea that they had previous incarnations. People identify with all sorts of mysterious Oriental mysticisms. Anything other than what we have here. I mean, it's perfectly true that what we have here is indeed deplorable in many ways, but then what we do is to apply reason in order to put what we have here right, not retreat into this sort of infantile world of idiotic, sentimental primitivism.
What have you seen recently that you liked on Broadway?
Nothing. I mean, I think. Oh no, it's not absolutely true. I think that Mamet and Shepherd and Rabe, or is he Rabe or Rab or what? I don't know how you pronounce his name. They produce really quite serious plays about the here and now, and they don't seem to me to be victims of these of this tosh.
I like this word, tosh. Is that one of yours, or does everyone in England say it?
It's an old-fashioned English public school term, which classics masters would simply say if you put up an argument which was patently ridiculous. They would say, "Now, Miller, you know perfectly well you're talking tosh." And I think that what I hear mostly today is tosh. Awful, sentimental, showbiz tosh.
You're doing brain research now, right?
Yes. I wouldn't exalt it or elevate it or dignify it with quite that term. I do research on the cognitive defects that follow from brain damage. I'm really not all that interested in the brain as such, in the sense that I could pursue most of the lines of research that I do without really knowing what was inside the head at all. I can happily pursue my research on the black box assumption that there's something in there, but I don't know what. I mean, that was in a way I'm almost indifferent to what the scientists would call the wetware, the actual circuits, the neurotransmitters. These really don't interest me enormously. What I'm interested in is to identify the actual cognitive performances that we are capable of. How do we remember? What do we remember? What are the details of the performances of memory? How does language break down when someone has a stroke? Without knowing anything about the inside of the head, I could spend the rest of my life very profitably, as indeed most neuropsychologists could, by simply looking at and parsing the details of linguistic breakdown following stroke. At some, it seems to me, almost infinitely postponed time, we might be able to bring together brain research knowledge and mind research knowledge. But at the moment, my interest lies in the performances of the brain rather than in its physiology.
One aspect of brain physiology that's become very trendy lately is the whole idea of the divided mind, the left and right hemisphere.
Well, yes.
And you were talking about creativity before, and for people who really want to be creativity, there's books that tell you how to exercise the proper side of your mind.
It's a sort of Jane Fonda of the cerebral cortex, you know, and they're sort of cerebral workout books. But again, it's tosh, and it's part of this sentimental egalitarianism which has overtaken modern society. And again, it goes back to this primitivism. It's the idea that on the right, somehow, are all the commendable, warm-hearted, imaginative, primitive, female values, whereas on the left hand are all the chauvinist, logical, technological, warfare, sort of missile-wielding capacities of the brain. And it's showbiz junk. It's the sort of thing you expect to hear in Sardis or in some awful patio in Beverly Hills, where someone who recently emerged from the 18th century, from their previous incarnation, now goes into something about having encouraged the right side of their brain to make them more creative. Well, it's almost too despicable and too idiotic to be worth talking about. But what is interesting is the fantasy which it reflects and of which it's an expression. It's a wonderful idea somehow that the brain really is a couple of fugitives from the chain gang, manacled together by the corpus callosum, a hideous, heartless accountant on the left, and a warm-hearted, creative finger painter on the right. And it's balderdash.
What do you do when you're directing a play and one of the leading actors in it really believes in this stuff? Because I'm sure that's happened.
Well, as we say in England, I send them up rotten. I mean, they know perfectly well that they'd better not talk that sort of stuff in front of me, because in fact, I become very impatient and I endlessly send them up. I can't stand that sort of stuff. It's so awful.
What's your sign? Oh, no, I'm sorry.
Well, you see, that's the sort of thing that one gets. I have been told my sign and consistently forget it. I cannot bear astrology, palmistry, acupuncture, homeopathy, any of these sorts of fugitive cults, which are flights from reason.
That's because the left side of your brain is overdeveloped, right?
Right.
You were in medical school, obviously being a doctor now. Did you come down with everything you were studying?
I was very healthy, and I did not jog or take any exercise or work out at all. I remained perfectly healthy while swatting at my books, and I don't think I ever took any exercise, and don't intend to now. Another thing, you see, is this intense desire to beautify oneself that goes on, particularly here in America, or put off death, or make sure that you look great.
I guess in one way, you know, I could say it's easy for you to put down all this renegade stuff because you've had a pretty healthy life. And
If I had been ill, I would have gone to a doctor. I don't put it down because I'm in a privileged position. Most of these opinions that I've been mocking are put forward by people who are in privileged positions, often very wealthy, famous people. Talk twaddle.
Your wife is a doctor, right?
Yeah.
Does she ever treat you when you're not feeling good?
Very flinchingly, because I don't fall ill very often. I sometimes have flu, or I get very bad pain in my back, which is not the result of some sort of failure of acupuncture. I got a bad back. I actually wrenched it very badly when I was a young doctor, picking a patient off the floor who'd had a fit. Huh. And it's been bad ever since. But I don't do anything about it. And my wife doesn't do anything about it at all. My wife is extremely impatient with my disorders and with the way I go on about things.
Your father studied hysterical paralysis.
Yes, he did, among other things, yes.
Isn't that one of the illnesses that doesn't really exist anymore?
Well, I think that it's changed its form. These things always re-express themselves in different ways. with the culture. There are things which are very not similar to it, but there are manifestations which are related to those ones which were seen at the end of the 19th century and the beginning of the 20th century. Certainly there aren't these dramatic shell shock paralyses that were seen at the time of the First World War. But then that's simply because men are not subjected to the sort of unremitting immobility that they were in the trench warfare of the First World War. I mean, what happens is the social conditions and the material conditions in which people suffer psychological stress actually determines how the symptoms will come out.
I was reading an article from 63 or 64, something about you in Life magazine, and it said that you stuttered.
Yes, well, yes. I, in fact, on this occasion, speaking to you, I've avoided many words unknown to you over which I would have stuttered.
My goodness, to have such a vocabulary and yet be avoiding words.
Well,
it's hard to imagine.
It's a very good way of improving one's word power, as the Reader's Digest would have said. If you really have had a stammer all your life, you become a master of instantaneous paraphrase, because you have to, unless you are, as it were, prepared, as some stammerers very bravely are prepared to do, just simply jam in public. And I don't like doing that, and therefore I will often choose a word which is not the one I wanted, and I find myself cursing. I find myself saying, I could have been much, much more eloquent about that. I could have used, you know, really the mot juste. Or I would have put that sentence round in a better form if I hadn't known that there was one word in it which was going to absolutely trip me up.
Did you do this on your own by trial and error? No.
I mean, I never thought of it, but that's how it's worked out. I mean, I don't, let it be said, have a really disabling stammer, in the sense that I can work my way around it. But it's certainly been difficult at times, and it's been I've had really quite serious troubles at times.
Did that have anything to do with you directing and not acting?
I think so. Yes, I think actually quite seriously that was. I left Beyond the Fringe early, both in England and in America, because it was beginning to trouble me. I could foresee, as the script became more and more familiar to me, even though I did improvise the stuff, and a lot of us improvised the stuff, there was a fairly set script, and I could see as I started out each night, down the rapids of the show, awful rocks, certain consonants sticking out, which were going to upset the canoe.
The new book that you've written is called The Facts of Life,
yeah.
And it has these great pop-ups in it,
yeah,
of the reproductive system. Mm. Remarkably, though, what's missing is the genitals.
Well, no.
Did I just miss them?
No, the genitals are there.
Oh.
I mean, they're there in the second two spreads. I mean, what there are not is very detailed accounts of the external genitals in great detail. That's mainly because I think it would be really very, very hard to sell a book when, in fact, if you opened it in the bookstore, quite suddenly pudenda were, as it were, conspicuous by their presence.
Have a lot of people made pop-up jokes about the male organs?
Yes, everyone has expected it to pop up in the appropriate way. I really, the real reason why I haven't done that is because you can't actually make the paper device work in anything other than a jocular and facetious way. If paper was more graceful and more flexible, then there would be a point in doing it. The only way in which we've used the paper is not to make things stick out, or to mobilize things in the way that they would be in nature, but really to render certain structures three-dimensional so that their connections are more intelligible than they would be otherwise. I mean, there are tremendous limitations upon paper engineering, and, pop-up's not intended to be taken that seriously. It's a nice, amusing entertainment through which, in fact, serious information can be conveyed. But, you can't do... I mean, there are very serious limits to what you can do with it.
The Facts of Life and the Human Body are both pop-up books. Do you ever get the reaction of like, ugh, when people see insides of
yes,
of
there
a
are
body?
Yes, there are always people who look at these things and there are cries of dismay and disgust. But on the whole, most people, as it were, feign these cries because, in fact, they know that that is the sort of response which is expected of people when faced with the interior and when faced with blood and guts. What I do know about the people's attitude to the interior is that many more people, when confronted with the actual fact, the real thing, the dead body, for example, even the opened dead body, medical students who see it for the first time who actually haven't been that inured to it, after the first shock, simply become interested. And often laymen I've sometimes been to an autopsy room with a layman, and they're shocked for the first 5 minutes, and then interest takes over. We do carefully cultivate the attitude of squeamishness. It's part and parcel of a whole system of scruples that we have about the allowed and the unallowed. I don't think we can ever see it on its own as something, just the fear of blood. It's part of a whole integrated system of the dangerous and the safe, the polluted and the pure. And I think many of these things are movable feasts, as some anthropologists have described them, and that we can actually shift the borders and boundaries quite easily simply by declaring them to have been moved.
Well, I think when I see images of the insides of bodies, it makes me feel more vulnerable because I can imagine more things specifically going wrong in my body, and I can feel pains in places
yes,
I didn't even know existed
before. I think that
before.
That happens, I think, probably, as it were, on the frontier. As you become acquainted with these things, and then you incorporate them, and then forget about them. When you become ill, perhaps you start to image these things again and see it more vividly. But it may well be that in certain forms of illness, being able to visualize your own interior enables you in some way to more actively participate in the outcome. Certainly, I think that this has been shown in certain...
I would have thought that's something you wouldn't believe in.
Well, no, I do believe in it, but I don't think it's mystical. I think that it's... I think that there's a perfectly intelligible explanation and a rational explanation that if, in fact, the interior is merely a dark vacuum, a void, from which issue catastrophes and events over which you have no control, you are, in the very true sense of the word, a patient, in other words, one who suffers. And whereas if the interior from which these events issue is known to you or can be visualized, even though you have no control over the events which issue from that interior, in some odd way, you can gain some sort of feedback control over it by being able to image it. I remember once having the extraordinary experience of being allowed to look in an X-ray department. I had to take a barium meal for a suspected peptic ulcer. And I asked the radiologist to turn the screen round, which he was looking at, in order so that I could see the stuff going through my own duodenum. And I, for the first time, I said, "Well, look, what do you seem to see? I've never been able to see my own duodenum. I wonder if I can wink it. I wonder if I can actually pull that sphincter and control it." And actually, because I could visualize it, I actually did succeed in winking it.
Huh.
And I don't know what I had to do in order to do it, but nevertheless, once it was. Once I had closed the circuit, I had control over it. Now, I don't think it's quite like that, visualizing your own interior. But nevertheless, I think that it probably has something to do with it. And I think that the biofeedback, which is so popular with these incarnationists, is probably part of that. We do have some sort of access to our interior, which is enhanced if you provide accurate images of what the interior is. Certainly it's been shown to be the case that patients who, for example, have got serious, even terminal forms of cancer, who are asked to visualize the cells and to visualize certain of their own healthy cells as indulging in combat, have shown statistically to have a higher rate of remission. Now, I don't think that's all that mysterious. It sounds mysterious at the moment, and very easily, I'm sure, that a sort of a dolphinish occult explanation would be imposed upon it. I think probably that we have access to these things through, amongst other things, the hypothalamic pituitary axis, and that down that pathway, control over hormones and control over immunology may in fact be obtained, and that the provision of a well-stocked imagination, or stocking the imagination with appropriate images, may in fact enhance the access that we have to this neurohypophyseal axis.
Time's really flown, and we only have about a minute left, but I'd like to ask you in that remaining time, since you are a doctor and a theater director, do either of those pursuits make you feel more morally righteous, you know, or more like you're really fulfilling your job during your life.
No, I don't. I never felt that, even when I was doing medicine. I mean, it's nice to be directly helpful to people, but there are all sorts of ways of being helpful to people. No, I don't feel morally righteous as a result of doing either of those two. I feel interested by them, and I'm sure that in the end they do people some sort of good. But there are lots of ways in which one does people good. You do people good by serving them in filling stations and by simply being a helpful and participant member of a community. I mean, we all do good and we all do bad.
Well, it's been a great pleasure to speak with you. I've really enjoyed this interview. Thanks for coming today.
Thank you very much, indeed.
Jonathan Miller has been my guest, and he's a doctor as well as theater director. He's currently doing neuropsychological research. And you've probably seen some of his programs on public television in America. The Body in Question was his series, and he also produced some and directed some of the series of the complete works of Shakespeare, which were shown on public television. He's written several books on health, including The Body in Question, The Human Body, and The Facts of Life. The Facts of Life is his latest, and it's about the reproductive system, the human reproductive system, and it's illustrated with three-dimensional pop-ups, so you could see the reproductive system in three-dimensional form. My guest's name again is Jonathan Miller, and his new book is published by Viking. It's 2 minutes to 5 o'clock, and we'll be joining National Public Radio at 5 for tonight's edition.